Namaste. So today in the series of Sanatana Dharma, I thought we'll touch upon little bit upon the Vedas. I don't know whether we can finish it in one talk or maybe we'll have two talks. But there are two ways of approaching the Veda. Let me clarify this part. One is the philological way. We pick up words, understand the meanings, and it's all right. It's very good, but it needs too much of in-depth understanding of the language. The language of the Vedas is not modern Sanskrit to start with. It's an archaic Sanskrit. Like today, we normally don't express to each other as thou. We say you. It has become our language today in English. But when you go back to Latin and all, it's very different. Now English has come from Latin, but it's very different. So the Sanskrit of the Vedas is different from the Sanskrit which we understand today. That's why when Sri Aurobindo interpreted the Vedas, interpreted is a way of saying he first had the experience of the Vedic mystics, number one. Second, Sri Krishna gave him the Nirukta. Nirukta is etymology of words, the grammar with which you can interpret. So by going from the words, and especially when we lack the experience. So I often use this example that in the absence of experience, imagine somebody has gone to Mansarovar and actually seen what a swan is. And comes and describes, you know, swan. Oh, is it? Okay, tell me about the swan. It's a white bird. Oh, white bird. Okay, it's the kingfisher. No, just the opposite. It's white wings. Oh, albatross, I know, I have read about it. You can't conceive because you have everything. Albatross, kingfisher, they all look like the swan outwardly. Unless you have seen, then you will say, what are you speaking? There is a world of difference between the two. So the correct way of recovery of the Vedas is through experience. And Sri Aurobindo speaks of that. He says, recover the ancient Aryan thought, recover the Vedas, recover the Upanishad. And then he says, not just in thought, but in life and action. This is the path of recovery. Because what really is Veda? It comes from the root called Vid, which means knowledge. But this is not ordinary knowledge. In the sense, it is a knowledge which cannot be perceived by the senses and the mind. So how do we know that such a knowledge exists? Well, the Vedic Rishis started in a very simple way. Even they were a continuation of the forefathers. That time nobody is written. The Vedic Rishis say we have received this lore from the forefathers. So there are two approaches to an ultimate reality. Obviously, Vedas are not for a person looking for practical things immediately. They are very practical. We'll come to that. But somebody who says, okay, immediately tell me how am I going to get my rations. So somebody will say, you vote for this party and you'll get your ration. So you're not even an adhikari of the Vedas. But as time comes when we seek for ultimate truths, we are not happy with just the everyday mundane practical truths of life because we see that they are all illusions. They collapse, they collapse, they collapse. So you want more, 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 and ultimately you reach in the process of dil mange more, that point that, you know, you want the ultimate truth. So how do you find the ultimate truth? There are two ways. One is the way of science. So you start from below, you start from the surface. You keep scratching, 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 keep digging, digging, and you climb up. It's a long, long process, but it's a valid process, not invalid. So science approaches this knowledge, this reality. But the problem there is the instruments are limited. Our instruments are the senses. And even if you augment them by some kind of a technology, even technology is an extension of the mind. Now, where did mind come from? So the Vedic Rishi started this question. Where does the mind come from? Where do the senses come from? So they inverted the question and therefore asked the right question. Instead of saying, I want to know the truth by the mind, ask this question, where does the mind come from? So they followed this trail by going into the depths within, into the subjective spaces, into mind, into thought, into feelings. Where does thought come from? Try just practicing one day. Where is thought coming from? Where is this feeling arising from? And you will start entering from the form of feeling into a formless state. And then you go deeper and deeper. So this is how they discovered a path. or rather they received a path from their forefathers and found the ultimate truth. Now the sign of that ultimate truth is it is stable, it is unchanging, and this is not a finite thing, it is infinite. That's why when people say, okay, tell us how God came into existence, this question is absurd from that point of view, because infinite by its nature cannot be born or die. It is by its nature infinite. So this question becomes invalid at that point of time. It's a very interesting way. It's mind-boggling. Just imagine how infinity came into existence. But this is the closest you can answer to the mind. Beyond it, you have to go and experience. So they went deeper and deeper and they discover. What did they discover? That yes, there is indeed an infinite truth, infinite existence behind this world of ever-changing motion. So they use the word prakriti for everything that is changing, which is having a form, name, born, dissolves, and this is not just one thing, two things, empires, civilizations. Just think on large scales. Empires come into existence and they dissolve. Somebody recently asked me a question. He said, sir, there are so many corrupt people around, this, that. I said, think about empires which have come and gone. Genghis Khan, Aurangzeb, such barbaric invaders who came. What all happened? All these empires, where have they gone? We don't even know whether they existed or not. Even think about the age of the Mahabharata. You have the TV serial and people doubt and debate whether it existed or not. So empires rise and fall. But what is behind all this? Is there a stable basis behind all this? And they discovered the stable basis that yes, behind all the manifold, varied, ever-changing, mutable appearances, there is the stable basis, and they use the word Brahman. Doesn't matter what name we use, that yes, there is an infinite existence. So we can approach it as the impersonal, universal basis behind everything. And from there, they started understanding the manifestation. Why it is practically important? Because when you understand the core, then you can understand what is the whole purpose, what it is, and then you can see. For example, let's say when we don't know the core and we experience little joys, so we are very happy, then the joy goes away and we say it is pain. So joy turns into pain. The same thing which gives joy gives pain. Have you noticed it? Even while you hold it, it is giving you pain. So we wonder why it is happening. So we blame it on karma. We blame it on this. So this is our understanding from below upward. Now you go to that. You discover that divine is, that one is infinite delight. The moment you say it is infinite delight, then you understand from there that all forms are limitations of that. So by its nature, because it cannot capture that totality of truth, therefore, whatever little joy it holds, it can never be happy fully because it's always seeking for infinite. And it is a grace that it breaks down, because then you seek further. Otherwise, you will be shut in the comfort zone. Then from there, when you understand this manifestation, then it all becomes so simple, natural, spontaneous. So they wanted to first understand that, and they found a path, and they discovered the ultimate knowledge. They use the word secret knowledge. We have a canto in Savitri for that. Why secret? Because you can't know it by the mind or the senses. So how are we to know it? Because we know this only. So they said you start from picking up any aspect, whether it be, you know, mind, or whether it be feelings, thought or feelings or will, and you start digging, going to its core. You have to use something of that, something which is provided within nature. It's like a key. It's like, you know, hide and seek game. So there is a clue left. You ever played that game? What is it called? Where you have the clues and you start hunting from the clue, treasure hunt. So there are clues dropped by nature, and you pick up that clue and go to its core. Actually anything, because that basis is there. A point comes when you will go beyond that frame through which you are seeking by the intensity of concentration, and you will discover that existence. And that path of discovery is called yoga. So the Vedic rishis were yogis, they were mystics. And they discovered. And they gave these truths. Now, the right way of discovering it is to discover the same truth. So there are two ways of going about the Vedas. One, as I said, is philological. We study the words. From words we derive the etymological meanings. And it's fascinating. But the problem with that approach is that a common man feels often repulsed. First of all, he says, Sanskrit, my God, it's too much for me. Then you say, Sanskrit also not this Sanskrit. It is a different Sanskrit. So it's too much of an effort. And after studying everything, you still don't have the experience. Mind you may study all the Vedic scriptures. Be a Pandit. Still you won't have the experience. So still something will be missing. And yet, there are people who are fascinated with that approach. And it's valid. I'm not saying it's not valid. But it is an approach which many times you will see. One of the reasons why the Vedas were lost within India is because people started studying them as the word, the scripture. And as time moved by, the scripture began to be interpreted in ways through the understanding of Sanskrit and the grammar as it changed over a period of time. So the meaning that was given was so strange. And therefore when Sri Aurobindo speaks of recovery of the Vedas, at both the levels he speaks of. It is not just philological and etymological. He says very clearly in Secret of the Vedas that I had certain experiences which I found confirmed in the rishis of the Vedas. Then he went about recovering it. Why? So that people know that there is so much beauty. So many have gone before. And what path they have taken. What did they discover? So he gives us the essence. But because there were a lot of already misinterpretations, he had to bring in that true understanding of the Vedas, both from philological point of view and the experiential point of view. So this is the longer path. The other path, which is also not a short path, but a path which is more, you know, consistent with logic and practicality, is to discover. Is there a way? How did they discover? And what are the main discoveries? That's what we need to know. Now when we use the word scholarly way, that there is Rig Veda, Sam Veda, Yajur Veda, Athar Veda, what does it mean? It's like Sri Aurobindo has written so many in the Arya from 1914 to 1921. Now, supposing somebody codifies it, takes out, okay, what Sri Aurobindo has written on love, what Sri Aurobindo has written on knowledge. That is how we had the paths, Bhakti Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Karma Yoga, they are not separate entities. So the Rig Veda, Sam Veda and Yajur Veda and Athar Veda later on, they are codifications. It was not like rishis were actually writing, okay, now I have written a hymn, it is Rig Vedic hymn. It's not how they went about. They had the experience and it expressed itself through a body of words, the mantra. And they expressed this body of words. Later on, another great rishi, Vedavyas most likely, or maybe Vedavyas was not one person, he took out those hymns like Patanjali. People think yoga means Patanjali. No, Patanjali is a codifier. He took out the various systems of yoga and made a little bit of good khichdi. So, you know, you have this and, you know. So, he created a system. And while system helps us to understand, but system can also become a problem because it takes away the natural movement. It's like, you know, when you say that, you know, how do I go from Delhi to Pondicherry? And you study all the route maps, take the data analysis, and finally you hone into take this flight, take that flight, take this train. Everything is in order. You take a flight. What is not given there is your flight may be cancelled. What do you do in that situation? Now, this is the problem of too much of codification. So, this is what happened. This is what has happened with the Vedas, that you have the Rig Veda, Sam Veda and Yajur Veda and subsequently Athar Veda as codification of certain hymns which came up in the heart of the rishis born by an experience. To give an example, when we are suddenly face to face with, you know, something very wonderful. Now, we may be stunned into silence or some words may well up within to give a form to that experience. For example, we may express, oh wow, what a wonder of wonders. Now, if it is expressive of a deep experience which is in the heart, then this word, wow, wonder of wonders, can be a mantra. But it is not expressive. You see, what was the mother's mantra for a long time? She said, I had to just use these two words, oh Lord, and she would connect. But if we speak, oh Lord, we can't connect, because we are not able to connect with the inner state in which these words are spoken. So there are the mantras, and there are states of consciousness they embody. So mantra is like a capsule of light. And if we only analyze the surface, we cannot arrive at the state of consciousness. For the state of consciousness, you have to dwell upon the mantra. Otherwise, you may learn all the mantras. And like a parrot, you see, parrots know many things. But parrot doesn't realize. But if you dwell upon the mantra, the meaning, Shobindo has beautifully describes in Savitri, as when the mantra sings in yoga's ear. And then the mind starts dwelling upon the index thought, but finds glorious hints, not the real thing. So after a while, it falls silent within itself to know. Then truth reveals itself. So this is how the mantra is born. It's behind the mantra is the state. So if you catch the word, you may miss the state. That's why the scripture says something very cryptic. It is there in the Upanishad, it's there in the Gita, that go beyond the word. Written or spoken. Shabd Brahma Ati Vartate. So what it means is, not that discard the word. Pick up the word if you wish. But go beyond means there is a state of consciousness embodied within it. If you try to understand it through the meaning with a dictionary, you may lose that state. So what was the method of the Vedic Rishis? It was not like that. The method was, you pick up a mantra and they meditated upon it. That's how they have given. They didn't give that, you know, try to understand the meaning. Okay, rough idea. Meaning is important in general. Like when you say Isha Vasya Midam Sarvam, it's enough to know that the Lord indwelling, immanent divine, dwells in all things. But if you say, well, Isha could mean this, it could also mean this. What does Isha really mean? Then you have lost it. Just when we meditate upon this famous verse, Isha Vasya Midam Sarvam. And if we do it, see, this was a path Sri Aurobindo himself followed. In the Alipur jail, he used to meditate on these two verses of the Isha Upanishad. But when people asked him that what is the best idea to meditate upon, he said the best is what is given in the Isha. But he didn't put the Sanskrit part. He said all is in the divine is in all, and all is the divine. He has given in English. It doesn't matter. It's the idea behind the body of words. Idea can express itself in different body of words. So again, Veda is not a fixed, rigid structure. You see the same idea which is there in the Veda about the one. You read the Sikh literature, you will see Ek Omkar. This too, that too. But it is written, it is said in Gurumukhi. And I know of people who just by listening to that, they have this wonderful experience. I mean, one of my friend, now he's in New York, so he would take me and he would put this Shabad onto his car. And I could see that, you know, Sikh gentleman, that he is absorbed in it. And it's so much touching. So it's not about the words, it's about the experience which is contained, the idea which is there. Behind the word, there is idea. And if you know the catch of the idea, you can express it in many more words. So Vedas are not a book which is finished. There will be more of it. Expressions will come. New expressions will come. And then behind the idea, there is the state of consciousness. That state of consciousness can suddenly seize upon a person without even knowing anything about the words. And I often use this example of Nishtha. Margaret Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, President of America's daughter. At 15, she is sitting in a garden and she's enjoying everything. And she says, oh, how nice. I wish the divine could enjoy all this. And she suddenly experiences all the joy rushing into her. And she's overwhelmed. And then she says, the thought that came into her is that who else but I am enjoying all this. Now what is this state? It is exactly same as Ishupanishad, tena taktena bhunjita magrida kasasvidhanam. She experienced the state of consciousness without using the words. Without going through words or even the idea. Why? Because she had a seeking and of course there is a past preparation. So we must understand that while it's all right to even with Savitri or anything, while it's all right to analyze words and all that. But most important is to get back to the experience. And to get to the experience, we need to know some key points, key issues that Vedas has said. Otherwise, many people, youngsters I have seen, some are committed. They want to study in the proper Sanskrit way. But as I said, it has its own problems. We may be lost in Panditya and forget the real sense. I mean, Sri Ramakrishna had not formally studied, but he had the experience. So much so that the famous Vedanti in Totapuri, he comes to him and says, "What is all this you say? Mother Kali, Mother Kali. No, 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 it's formless, Brahman, infinite." So Sri Ramakrishna said, "What is this?" So he goes and tells the mother, "You know, this fellow, he is supposed to be my guru." He could accept anyway. "Okay, you teach me this sadhana," because he was to synthesize the different sadhanas. He was not meant to synthesize matter and spirit, but at least the different approaches, religious, spiritual, different approaches. So he did tantra sadhana, this sadhana. So he goes and tells mother, "He is telling me that all this is, that all that I talk to you is not true. There is something beyond." So she says, "Okay, I'll tell him." Next day his master comes and says, "What did you do?" He was tormented literally by Mother Kali, that, "What are you speaking? You don't know me. You don't know the Brahman till you have known this great truth." So there are approaches, but ultimately we have to come to this approach, which is the approach of experience. So that's where he gives us certain key aspects. And if one wants to know where these key aspects are, there is a very beautiful essay of Sri Aurobindo. It comes in Doctrine of the Mystics. It used to be in Hymns to Mystic Fire in the SABCL. I think now it is in CWSA, which volume? I am not well conversant with the modern this thing, but I think now it has come in Vedic and Philology Studies. But there he explains what these mystics discovered and gave to us. It's very simple. And that's what we need to know. Then if we are interested, we can go into experience, we can go into words, analysis, but most importantly experience, and along with that we can study. So the first thing that he describes very beautifully, I'll just read portions of it. The doctrine of the mystics, but first he says that what were the Vedic rishis seeking? What was their seeking? So first they were seeking immortality. Immortality means not the way we understand survival of a limited personality. They saw that everything is changing. Is there something which is unchangeable? See, destruction is synonymous. The moment you have birth into a form, destruction comes into place. Think about it this way. Mortality is not just when I die physically. Ever thought that when you were a child, seen your picture, you're no more the same physically? What happened? Shall we say that one is dead? People will say this is absurd. There is a continuity. How do you know it? So the next thing will be, there is memory. Do you remember everything? I don't remember everything. You can reclaim that memory and understand the continuity. There is a way to reclaim that memory. Otherwise you rely on what the parents say and others say. But you can, there are ways. Nowadays people speak about regression, where you can actually reclaim that memory which you have lost. And therefore you know this changeable person, and that person who was, and this who is, and that which other will be, are actually the same person. But these are all changing appearances. Isn't it? So the same way, apply it on a much larger scale. So when they use the word, there is something which is not changed, which is stable. Now you will say, no, but that has also changed in terms of capacities, personalities. Yes, personality is also changing. Child's personality and grown up and this thing. So what is behind this personality? So this is how they were approaching immortality, that is there something which doesn't change? So immortality was not just that how I'll survive from death. That meaning has come much later. And they discovered that yes, there is something that doesn't change, which is not limited by form and name. It is infinite, so therefore it cannot die. Infinite cannot die, finite can die. It doesn't die even finite. Its boundaries are abolished. So it's like a house. So when you demolish the boundaries, you can say the house is pulled down. But the land is still there. It continues to exist. The walls were a temporary structure. So temporary structures will come up and fail. But the fundamental reality will remain. There is another example which is used in terms of understanding this, is the river and the bed. So we go and say, the river, is the river the same or is it changing? Interesting question, no? A river is never the same. Every moment it is changing. Yet we say that the river is the same. Why do we say that? The river bed is there. It is flowing along those paths. If the same river or another stream coming from the same origin flows along another river bed, we will say it's a different river. So it is changing and yet it is not changing. Similarly, in nature, we see certain patterns, tendencies, habits, and we think it is fixed, but it is not fixed. It is only temporarily there. It's constantly changing. So they went into all these constant changes. And then they discovered, no, but there is a bed which is not changing, over which this nature is dancing. This bed is the infinite existence which is immortal. So this was their first seeking. They use the word truth. Why? Because it is the last point. So it is truth. All others are truths or relative truths. And every relative truth can become falsehood. By saying relative truth means it is playing in space and time. Let's take for example certain religions. So in a certain context, they were true. Certain religions were born amidst very barbaric human beings. So one of their doctrine was, if somebody commits this, chop off the head and the hands. Now, you know, there was a context to it. Now, in that time and space, it is true. But you change the context, time flows by, and unless you keep on upgrading it, it becomes falsehood. The same thing. So there is one truth which is unchanging, eternal. And there are other things which are changeable. So in Vedas also we find that there are certain truths which are fundamental. But also certain ritualistic things. They have been interpreted as rituals. They also carry the deeper meaning. But outer things. So those outer things, you have to get the inner truth. Then only one can lead a Vedic life. Take for example the weddings. Or yagna, simple thing. So how was yagna done in the Vedic age? Every time you tune into any of the serials, how do you see the yagna? There is somebody who is making bricks and lighting a fire, pouring gritam. Suddenly two demons will come on top and ha ha ha, and they are pouring blood. And then there will be Rama and Lakshmana killing Taraka. You know, that image, that's how we have. But this is an image. And it's not to say that outer yagna doesn't have a meaning. It has a meaning. You can do that. In those ages, people were doing it. Now if you do it, there will be fire alarm. You can't do it. Now yagna has a deeper truth. That is unchanging, which we have spoken about. So yagna is about the law of sacrifice. But you can do from the outer. See, it's a good support. That every time you say, it's like the same thing with mala. Now, when do you use mala? There are some people who will use the mala. So why do you use the mala? Because they can't. Anybody you see using mala means mind is absolutely fickle. You can't concentrate. So what you are doing? You are doing Ram, 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 Ram. But mind is fickle. So after some time, this is going on. And Mukh mein Ram, Bagal mein Churi. Because this is an aid. Don't turn the aid into the real thing. It's a prop. So for some it may work very well that you actually light up. It's a wonderful thing, no? When you pour and all, you have a mandap and you have the Durga pandal. And of course that is more into Tantra. We'll talk about it later because it's a different domain. But you have a method, a system where you are doing, and every time you take a mantra, it's a beautiful feeling. Nobody can deny. But that is not the real thing. The real thing is the yagna inside. So after all this pouring in, you say, well, now the yagya is over. Now please give me my dole. You know, that's how the priest says, give me my money. Now you're finished, because it was never a yagna to start with. So always it is the inner truth which should take precedence. That's why the forms will change, but the inner truth will remain. So this is what Sri Aurobindo brings. So that inner truth is something which is unchanging. So he speaks about, starts with, the doctrine of the mystics recognizes an unknowable, timeless and unnameable, behind and above all things, and not seizable by the studious pursuit of the mind. In the beginning itself, he is making it clear. It is unknowable. Unknowable to what? To the mind and the senses. So how did they know it? There is a way of knowing it by identification of consciousness. There is within us something other than mind, which is the primary of which mind itself is born. So by extracting the consciousness from its engagement into the mind and senses, we normally think that this is me, my thoughts are me. You know, that's the difference. In Western philosophy it is said, I think, therefore I am. But in Indian thought it is, I am. Whether I think or I don't think. This consciousness is involved in the mind. Therefore, at that point it is identified with the mind and therefore I think. Let's take an example. Morning, sometimes we may be overtaken by a kind of emotion. So what do we say? I am feeling good. Hopefully. Most people in the morning feel good. And then toward the evening, you may be tired. I don't know, I'm not feeling. So what was it? Feelings were changing. You are the same. Because the I identified with this, you felt good. Now the I is identified with this, so you feel bad. But you can learn to take the consciousness behind this identification and discover that freedom. So behind all this, we come back to that. Name and forms are simply constructs, devices, into which that which is beyond names and beyond forms and is unknowable in this framework has invested itself. So this is the fundamental truth, and he says it is, you cannot seize it by the studious pursuit of the mind. Very first sentence. Impersonally, it is that, the one existence. To the pursuit of our personality, it reveals itself out of the secrecy of things as the God or Deva. So here comes a twist. Is it this or that? You see, it is both. Everything in this world is at once impersonal and personal. Look at it very simply. Is electricity an impersonal thing or personal thing? Both. As an electrical energy, it exists in cosmos. But it is there as personal. You have these conduits through which it expresses itself. But here he goes still further. An infinite existence, and this is a very simple logic to those who say that God is a being you are humanizing. No, you're not humanizing him. It's the other way around. So if there is an existence which is aware of itself, what do you say? You say, when we are aware of ourselves, that's why I say, no, that I. Now whatever I am aware of, that will be the I. I may be aware of the ego self, and when I say I, it is about my ego self. Or I may be aware of a deeper psychic truth, and when I say I, it means that. Or when I am aware of a higher divine truth and identified with that, when you say I, it means that. So it's not about the use of words. There are people who are very touchy about use of words. So one of my friend long back sent a card, marriage card. So here he says, Priya Atman. Starts with this, so very impersonal. You don't know whom he's addressing. And then he says, this Atman is marrying that Atman. Everything. So I asked him, good friend, I said, whom are you inviting? Atman? Then Atman is, are you going to give some food to this Annam? Or it will only be all Atman? As disembodied. So now, you have both aspects. You have impersonality and personality. They are always together. Everywhere in creation, like wave and particle. So we can approach the one, but it is infinite existence, which is also infinite consciousness. That consciousness with which everything else you can be aware of. So won't that consciousness be aware of its own existence? Of course it is. It's logical, and that is how it's described. The divine is aware of himself by his own consciousness. So if you are aware of yourself, what are you? A being or non-being? It is being. So why do some people use the word non-being? Because it doesn't correspond to any idea of being. So equally you can say being, you can equally say non-being. But he's a being. You can enter into relation with him because he's a being. And whatever relation you want, you can enter. Because out of that being, all other becomings, all other beings have all kinds of personality. So you can connect with that being in whatever small way. So he says he can reveal himself as infinite existence, unknowable, unnameable. But to the pursuit of personality, you discover him as the Deva. Now this is not one God. This is not gods, but the one God, Deva, the Supreme. Nameless though, he has many names. So though he is beyond names, he can assume any name. Why not? You see, even an ordinary human being in life has many names. There is a nickname through which he was called as a baby. Then when he grows up, there is a name in the school, official name. Then he has a name which his friends call him with. Then he gets married. Then his husband or wife calls with another name. So you have at least four names. Then when he grows up, children connect with another name. And there also you have a range from dad, papa, pop, pops. Almost coming close to pop. So, you know, moms, mom, mummy. I used to call Mataji. Now if I say it looks so archaic. Mataji, Pitaji. I used to call like that. Well, that's how I'd grown up. Pitaji, Charan Chukya Ashirvad. Now, you know, if my son calls me Pitaji, I'll be shocked. I'll wonder, are you okay? Is everything okay? Dad is okay. So, but does it mean a difference? No. He is one. He's the same. Whether he calls me Pitaji, Papa, one day he called me a friend. Suddenly he discovered at 12 years age, we are taking a walk and he put his arms, he had grown up to my height, put his arms around my neck very conveniently. And he says, you know what, I feel like a friend. I said, good. So let's talk friend, friend. So I said, so friends we can call names. He said, yes. Does it make a difference? It's the same person. So he is one, but he can assume many names. Also depending upon which aspect, which dimension we are approaching. So this is something as simple as that. He can approach many names. He can have many names. Immeasurable and beyond description, though he holds in himself all description of name and knowledge and all measures of form and substance, foods and activity. So every name in this world actually, unless it is nonsensical, but even that carries a sense, is actually the name of the divine. And once I had played with it in many ways in my head. So then I said, what about nonsensical names? Some people have names which have no meaning. Doesn't matter, because there is a state of the divine where you lose all meaning. So even nonsensical names. Otherwise you take up any name and you can attach it to some aspect of the divine. Including names like Moha. Why? He is the one who is the origin, no? The origin. Moh Moh ke dhage ka real origin is there. So you see, you take any name and you can find its origin there. So that's why we have Aditya Sahasranam, we have Vishnu Sahasranam, Lalita Sahasranam. But why only 1,000? You can have 10,000 million names. Every name is expressive of a quality. Every quality has its divine origin. So that's a different way of looking at the creation. Mountain, something of the divine. Singer, something of the divine. Even snake, something of the divine. Everything has something of the divine. So every name, every form, every activity, every quality, he informs. But at the same time, he is not limited by that. So you can say he is beyond all names. And he is the unnameable, unnameable one. He is the formless one, even though he assumes all the forms. So I think we'll stop here. As I said, it will, it's probably will need a few, I don't have the right word. It's not deliberations. talks sounds very much, you know, reflections. This is good. It will need a few reflections into the Vedas as revealed to us by Sri Aurobindo. Today is more of the background.